Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the must not take yourself too seriously and 6-1 since that matters. And what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble. With exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello. I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast, done in partnership with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. Just a decade ago, before COVID upended everything, tens of thousands of migrants from African countries traveled to China in search of economic opportunity. One 2012 estimate put the African population in Guangzhou alone at 100,000. When the British-Nigerian travel writer Nawsara Wiwa heard about this community, she decided to travel to Guangzhou and China to learn more. She met traders, drug dealers, surgeons, visa overstayers, four professional athletes, and many more trying to live, work, and stay in China. Her travels are the subject of her new book, Black Ghosts, A Journey into the Lives of Africans in China, from Canongate. Naw is a travel author and journalist. Born in Nigeria and raised in England, she writes for Condé Nast Traveler magazine and contributes book reviews, travel opinion, and articles for The Guardian, The Financial Times, and The Times Literary Supplement, among others. Her first book, Looking for Trans Wonderland, Travels in Nigeria, was up to critical acclaim in 2012 and was named the Sunday Times Travel Book of the Year. Today, we talk about Naw's experiences in Guangzhou, the prejudice African immigrants faced in China, and the prejudices they brought with them, and what this migration says about South-South relations. So Naw, thank you for coming on the Asian Review Books podcast to talk about Black Ghosts, A Journey into the Lives of Africans in China. Why were you interested in this community in the first place? What attracted you to writing about migrants from Africa traveling to Guangdong province?
Well, I remember first hearing about Africans in China in a newspaper or a website, and I was just amazed. I was astounded that Africans had made lives in China. We're so used to the African diaspora, of which I'm a part, living in, Europe and the US and places like that. But Asia, and particularly China, is a whole different cultural universe. When it comes to Europe, there's a connection, there's language because of colonization, and there's religion and a kind of overlap in music and things like that. Whereas with China, there was none of those things. It's just a very, very foreign kind of place. And the language also is really difficult. It's notoriously difficult to learn Chinese, and to write it is near impossible for most people. So again, the idea of Africans going over to a country like that seems to me the hardest sort of migration. And obviously China is not known for being politically correct either. And so when it comes to race and things like that, I think as Black people, making a life in China seemed to me a really brave move. So I was just fascinated to see what kind of lives they created for themselves over there and how they were faring.
So who actually are these migrants? I know it's a big community and they're all going for different reasons, but why do they travel to China? What do they do once they're there? Is it difficult for them to get to China because of immigration rules? Just kind of who are these people from Africa who are moving to Guangdong province and elsewhere?
So yeah, it's a very big community It's a diverse community. I mean, there are lots of different types of Africans from different countries and different social economic groups going over there. So I was focusing on Africans who live in certain neighborhoods in Guangzhou, in the south of China near Hong Kong. And that's like the hub of the African community. But they can be quite different from, let's say, the Africans you might encounter in Shanghai, who might be graphic designers and doctors and that sort of thing. So yeah, I was focusing on Guangzhou. And a lot of these African immigrants, they started going over there in the 90s to buy small commodities from China, which is, of course, the manufacturer of the world. And so they would make money by buying these small commodities and then sending them back home to their various countries and selling them for a profit. And China facilitated this by giving people visas, like 30-day visas. And for Africans, and you know, let's say Nigerians in particular, that kind of access to foreign countries is really quite rare. You know, with a Nigerian passport, it's almost impossible to enter Europe, the US, and places like that very easily. You have to have a degree, a job, or have a lot of money. But you know, China sort of offered a mobility for very ordinary Africans that a lot of other richer countries weren't doing. And so, you know, it sort of really it made life a lot easier for small entrepreneurs who might want to buy fabrics or, you know, just anything. It could be furniture, food, and, you know, just make a sort of import-export business out of it. And so initially it started off with Somalians who, some of them had been students in China, and once they graduated, they just stayed on and decided to do this import-export thing. And because they were Muslim, they decided to settle in the Sanyuanli area of Guangzhou, which already had a sort of Chinese Muslim Uyghur population. And that's how it started. And the community really started to grow. And it, you know, by 2008, it had become quite big, and there were sort of estimates of anything up to 200,000 people living there. And so, yeah, that's how that community was born.
So you meet a lot of people on your journey. Who were some of the more memorable people you met while in China, whether in Guangzhou or elsewhere?
Yeah, well, there was one guy, Coffee. He was from Ghana, and he was a cardiac surgeon. And he was really interesting because, you know, for starters, he actually qualified. He got his medical degree in China, which for me is, you know, to get a medical degree anyway is achievement enough. But to do it in a foreign language and in Chinese at that is, you know, quite stunning. And you know, I met a lot of Africans who had this incredible linguistic ability on top of everything else. And yeah, so Coffee was fascinating because through his job, he had a very unique insight into Chinese culture and insight into the way that, you know, they treat Africans. And yeah, it was just fascinating. Because in China, medicine is more holistic. It means that when you're a doctor, people come to you with their personal problems as well. And so he would get the lowdown on people's marital problems and things like that. And, you know, initially when his Chinese patients first encountered him, they were horrified, you know, that we can't have a black man treating me and that sort of thing. But, you know, Coffee said that once they actually realized that he was good at his job and he was very effective in treating them, they kind of changed their minds. And so you know, he's of the opinion that Chinese people, yes, can be very prejudiced and racist, but he says that they're also quite meritocratic. And, you know, if you do your job properly, then they accept you as being good at your job. Whereas, you know, perhaps in the West, that hasn't always been the case. So yeah, his you know, he told me a lot of very interesting things, and so you know, he sticks out in particular.
Yeah, I mean, he makes some interesting points, doesn't he? Where it's like he how some of his patients don't believe him to be the doctor, and so he maneuvers his Chinese colleagues to treat him with respect, so that the Chinese patients go, "Oh, I guess I have to trust this guy because my Chinese doctor is trusting him."
Exactly. You know, he has to get validation first from a Chinese doctor, his Chinese superior. But then once that happens, then the patients gained his trust.
That's a good segue to kind of a broader question, which is kind of how local Chinese viewed the African community, or just viewed, you know, African individuals like yourself. You know, several people you talk to note instances of prejudice and harassment, or just let's say, or ignorance. You get some of this as well. How did local Chinese kind of view the African community and kind of African individuals?
Yeah, well, it's important to remember that the vast majority of Chinese people haven't actually had any personal interactions with Africans, even the ones living in China. And so a lot of their opinions, they obtain them from footage they've seen on the internet and that sort of thing. So there is a lot of prejudice. There is a lot of, which is, you know, born out of anti-blackness, but also a sort of pro-Chinese, China first nationalism, which means that there's prejudice towards all foreigners, but obviously Black Africans tend to be at the bottom of the pecking order in the hierarchy of, you know, the average Chinese mind. I found that, you know, the people who had the closest proximity to Africans, that people in Guangzhou, were sort of more open-minded. I mean, I personally wasn't stared at half as much in Guangzhou as I was when I then started traveling around the rest of the country. You know, the rest of the country, it's a very different story. A lot of giggles and stares and who knows what they're saying, you know, because you can't understand Chinese. The Africans who do understand Chinese, yeah, they hear a lot of, you know, unpleasant things. And, you know, there was that infamous TV commercial where a Black man was seen entering a washing machine, and then he came out as a sort of clean Chinese man. And that sort of got global notoriety. So, yeah, you know, the Chinese are sort of well behind the West in terms of, you know, trying to be more progressive in race relations. And but at the same time, they're also, I would say that perhaps they're no different from the West. They're just more frank. But also for some of them, as, you know, as Coffee, the cardiac surgeon, suggests, that it's easy to turn their opinion if they have had an interaction with you and you prove yourself professionally or otherwise.
I want to ask the inverse question to this. I asked kind of how did Chinese people see the African community? How did African immigrants see China and see its political system, see its society? You definitely meet a couple of migrants who compare their homes to China often comparing their homes unfavorably to China and some of the things that it had done. But what were some of the views that African migrants had about China?
Yeah, I mean, I encountered a whole range of views, but the ones that, you know, I suppose sort of stuck in my mind and, you know, surprised me a little bit, were, you know, were the people who really sort of valued China's, not so much, it's not the lack of democracy, but the strong government, you know, that, because that's what they felt was lacking in Nigeria. I mean, the guys I was talking to, they were Nigerians. And when they looked at China, they look at a government that, yes, is not democratic, but it is actually making an effort to lift its people out of poverty. And it is building infrastructure. And it feels that its legitimacy rests on improving people's standard of living. Otherwise, the government knows that there'll be trouble ahead. And so, you know, some of the Nigerians that I spoke to admired that. They obviously, you know, understood that it's not all roses. And they see that there is a certain freedom that they have in Nigeria that they don't have in China. But just that strong government that is actually, you know, willing to pull its citizens out of poverty, it is something that, you know, does appeal to a lot of the Africans that I met.
You know, did African immigrants in China, did they see themselves as one community? Megan, you note in talking to African migrants that they brought a lot of, you know, they brought a lot of stereotypes about other African groups with them. You know, the Igbo say a lot of not very nice things about the Yoruba. So they brought these views with them to China. But did you get a sense that the African community saw themselves as a single community, or was there, I guess, more solidarity in that community because they were all Africans in China?
Yeah, I think with humans in general, we're sort of very interesting. We have our little units and our little divisions, but then we can also come together in broader terms. And that's what you saw in China. You would have all these different sort of organic grassroots associations. Like, so you had the Association of Nigerians in China, and they would come together and they'd pool money and they would help each other out, and it would be people of all different ethnicities within Nigeria. But at the same time, you know, there are those ethnic tensions that you see in Nigeria, and those were brought over to China as well. And obviously, you know, some people, it depends who you talk to, some individuals are more sophisticated than others. And so, you know, you would get some people who are very, would make some very ridiculous stereotypes about the other ethnic group, yeah, the Igbo and the Yoruba, that sort of thing. But you know, there is a Nigerian association, which is all the different ethnicities come together. And it's a very effective organization, which, you know, tries to support the African community out there, whether it's money or legal help or anything else.
So you also, I mean, you also travel to Hong Kong and you meet some African migrants in places like Chungking Mansions, you know, that very famous building in Hong Kong on the Kowloon side. Did you see any differences between mainland China and Hong Kong in terms of their African communities, in terms of how they saw their place in society, how, like, the kinds of jobs they were doing? What were the differences on both sides of that border?
Yeah, because Hong Kong is, although it's a part of China, it's still excuse me, it's still subject to British law in some ways. And so as a result, you did see particularly Anglophone Africans seeking asylum in Hong Kong in a way that they're not able to do on the mainland. And they also had jobs as construction workers, that sort of thing, which you wouldn't have seen on the mainland. So, you know, slightly different. There is a sense of that British Commonwealth influence in Hong Kong. And but I would say in terms of opportunities, it's pretty equal between the mainland and Hong Kong, I would say. There are a lot of Africans in on the mainland who had made really sort of successful lives for themselves. They tend to be the ones who are very quiet and don't want to be interviewed. But, you know, they are there, and they're actually quite wealthy and have made really good lives for themselves. And I think that's something that they were able to do on the mainland, And I would imagine that's harder in Hong Kong. I mean, Hong Kong is smaller and more densely populated, and the opportunities aren't quite as the same as they are on the mainland.
You know, one historical detail you get into in your book are some of the earliest African migrants to communist China, which are these students that kind of travel to China, I guess, to learn about communism, and it's not a very fun time. The lessons aren't great, and they aren't under a lot of prejudice. I wonder if I talk about some of these, like these earliest African students that came to China and their experience.
Yeah, I mean, I learned about their experiences when I came across a book by Emmanuel Hevy, who was a Ghanaian student in China in the 1960s. And he wrote a book about his experiences, which wasn't particularly flattering towards China. But he talks about how, you know, China invited all these international students over as a sort of soft power move to maintain some sort of cultural and therefore political influence over Africa as part of its rivalry with the Soviet Union and the West. And so you had a lot of African students going over in the 60s and 70s. And because they were foreign students and the Chinese Communist Party wanted to impress them, they gave these foreign students preferential treatment in terms of quality of accommodation and access to foreign goods, because this is the communist era. So a lot of the Chinese students and Chinese people in general couldn't buy that many foreign products. But the African students could go to what they call the friendship stores and buy money, you know, buy things. And they had like bigger stipends as well compared to the Chinese students. And so that bred some resentment. You know, the Chinese students felt very overlooked. And of course, some of the female Chinese students then wanted to date these foreign students, these African students. And so you can imagine there was some extra tension there as well. But also, Emmanuel Hevy, in his book, he talks about his dissatisfaction at wanting to learn whatever subject he'd gone to China to learn, and instead they tried to indoctrinate him and feed him a lot of lines about how good communism is, et cetera, et cetera. And he was very frustrated by this because he felt that he wasn't receiving the kind of education that he wanted. And it was, you know, it's a very sort of fascinating time, and the tensions, that kind of sexual tension that developed between Chinese male students and African male students, it boiled over in universities like Nanjing, where you ended up, there was like a riot in the very early 90s, and a lot of African students ended up being rounded up and deported because the male Chinese students resented them dating the girls, and a fight broke out. And so, it was a very sort of interesting time back then.
So you're doing all of this travel before the COVID pandemic changed everything. In fact, you were in Wuhan just a few months before, right before the COVID pandemic first emerges in that city. What's happened since COVID? How has that changed patterns of migration into China?
Yeah, well, obviously, you know, because of COVID, a lot of Africans went back home to their home countries. Some stayed behind, and it made headline news. You know, the treatment that they received during the pandemic was pretty tough. Some of them weren't allowed to stay in hotels. They had to sleep out on the street, and they were blamed by some Chinese people for spreading this disease. But so the African community was, you know, quite subdued by COVID. And I went back last year in October last year. And yeah, there was a definite change, far fewer shops, far fewer people. But that was partly because China took a long time to open up. And so, you know, people were starting to come back. I mean, I was told that the numbers that I was seeing in October last year was actually higher than compared to February last year. So people were starting to come back, but you know, things are difficult now. And I know in Nigeria, the currency is losing value, and it means that those kind of small commodities traders, it's not such a favorable environment for them. It's not so profitable for them to go over to China and buy products and send them back. So fewer people are doing that, yeah.
So the interesting thing to me about African migration to China, you know, is that it's an example of, I guess, quote unquote, South-South relations, you know, again, the quote unquote global South. It's a relationship that's not intermediated by Europe, by the UK, or by the US. It's a direct relationship. And so what do you think, you know, from your going to these communities, talking to people, kind of reporting this out, you know, what does it tell us about, you know, again, quote unquote, South-South relations, not in terms of the political buzzword, but in terms of what people are actually doing?
There are some people who really celebrated this South-South relationship. You know, they felt that China's relationship with all the different African countries was somehow a step up from the colonial relationship and post-colonial relationship that Africa has had with Europe and the West in general. I would say that, you know, colonialism or China's engagement with Africa, they're all rooted in the same fundamental motive, which is to make a profit. But because China doesn't have that colonial history, it doesn't have those links with slavery, et cetera, it means that there's less of that, I don't know, I suppose, guilt. And so in terms of, let's say, visa access and people's fundamental human rights, Africans' human rights in China, I would say it's far worse than Africans who live in Europe. But at the same time, the economies of China compared to Europe is also very different. You have a lot of Africans who will go to the West to fill job vacancies that exist over there. Whereas in China, China doesn't have that problem. It's not looking for, you know, low-skilled or even high-skilled workers. You know, it can fill those roles itself. So it just makes for a very different kind of relationship. I think it's very imbalanced. China is given a level of access in Africa, whether it's diplomatic access or economic, far more than vice versa. And when China invests in Africa and builds infrastructure such as railway lines, they'll often bring their own laborers. They're not employing Africans on the ground, and therefore they're not increasing the capacity or raising the skill set of Africans in any way. And so people question this relationship and just how beneficial it is to Africa. So, you know, South-South relations, it's different, it's unprecedented. Whether it's actually better, I don't know. But being in Guangzhou was really interesting because they call it the capital of the third world. And it was amazing to go to nightclubs, for instance, and seeing all these different people from around the world, all these different nationalities, but almost none of them were white European. It was Malians and Nigerians dancing with people from Polynesia and Colombians and as well as a few Chinese. And that was really interesting to see this sort of globalization that is not mediated by the West. It is very different. And who knows, that could be a glimpse into the future.
So I think that's a great place to end an interview with Nawsar Wiwa, author of Black Ghosts, A Journey into the Lives of Africans in China. Now, I actually have two final questions for you, which are, where can people find your work? Not just this book, but all of your work. And what's next for you? What do you think the next project might be?
Well, my policy now is never to talk about my next project until it's actually done.
It's probably a good policy.
Yes, because otherwise you spend years just talking about it and people start to get impatient. And my work, I have a personal website. It's just nawsarawiwa.com. And you can find links to all my articles as a journalist, as well as links to my first book, which was about my travels around Nigeria. And it's a one-stop shop for everything.
So you can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at @NickRIGordon. That's NickRIGordon. You can go to AsianReviewBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Twitter at @BookReviewsAsia. That's reviews plural. And you can find many more author interviews at the New Books Network and NewBooksNetwork.com. We're on all of your favorite podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify. Rate us, recommend us, share us with your friends to support us interviewing those writing in, around, and about Asia. Next week, join us for an interview with David Vevers, author of The Great Defiance, How the World Took on the British Empire. But before then, Naw, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.